thank you all for coming. We really appreciate it. The governor was very, you know, she's obviously happy to be where she is, but she was sorry to miss this meeting. She looks forward to seeing you all and to hear how things are going. There's lots to talk about. So, what you would usually do is start with conversation about the budget. I find that to be kind of a downer. So we can do that if you want, and I'm happy to kind of roll through where we are, or we can do it at the end, sort of after you all talk about the things that are most pressing on your minds.
Well, speaking for the rest of it, hi, Bob.
Hi.
We hear very concise, succinct, intelligible reports from our director and deputy director uh-huh. about the budget projections, so we're fairly up to speed
Great.
On the outlook, the problem coming mm-hmm. at us.
Good. Well, maybe I can just fill in a little bit then, so it won't be so depressing because the news won't be new, but the way the governor's working on things now is we think it'll be about a $1.1 billion problem statement when the revenue forecast and caseload forecast come out next Wednesday. They think we might be as much as $200 million down on revenue, but we think we will be able to recognize about $166 million in savings from the implementation of the Affordable Care Act. That's primarily from people who are currently on state-funded healthcare programs that will move over to will not be federally funded healthcare programs. So it'll be a rough balance on the two. The governor, by statute, is required to balance a budget to that amount, and she will do that. And to get there, it will require substantial cuts and lots of programs. That's always concerning because nobody likes to even, there are people who say we shouldn't try to show a pathway to a place where we don't want to go. But that's her obligation, and we are working hard to try to come up with a path forward. Within that $1.1 billion, there are some things that we think the legislature is unlikely to fund and unlikely to allow to expire. For example, there's about both the Initiative 732, which is COLAs for K-12 teachers, and Family Leave Act, and a couple smaller things. There are some statutory obligations that the legislature has not funded over the last couple years that are still within that $1.1 billion number. Those are worth cumulatively about $330 to $350 million. So you can kind of take those off the table right away. So our operative problem statement then, outside of that first budget, and the governor right now is still thinking to do a second budget, down here they call it book two, and the $1.1 billion figure also assumes what is current law, and that is the expiration of the increase to the B&O tax that the legislature did 2 years ago, and there's a beer tax and a couple other smaller things that expire at the end of this biennium. The governor may propose a budget that would contemplate the extension of those, which together, those are probably worth another $350 some million. So then you start getting to a problem statement that looks more like $400 million instead of $1.1 billion, which, you know, $400 million is still a lot of money, but it's a different scale and scope of problem than what we were looking at otherwise. We have that, plus the direction from the Supreme Court that the current funding for K-12 is inadequate, a Cleary decision, and the governor is contemplating, has not yet made a decision on whether she will propose a methodology through which the legislature could fund that outstanding obligation, which is about $1 billion in the next biennium. The challenge with that is that the obligations under the existing law, the education reforms the legislature's done the last couple of years, increase over the next couple biennium and sort of flatten out at about $3.4 billion. So what you really need is a revenue source identified, whether from existing programs that are not going to be funded from the general fund or from new revenues, that increase over time from about $1 billion next biennium to $3.4 in the third biennium following. That's a lot of money. And so there are folks advocating very strong on both sides. Some think she shouldn't say anything about it. She's on her way out. She should leave it to the new people to come up with a plan. Others think it's easier for her to put out a number than new people coming in who don't want to come out of the gates putting some new revenue source or more reductions in services on the table. I'm sure we'll get a lot of constructive input from folks in the coming weeks on that. The other question that's out there that she's that we're spending a lot of time thinking about is whether to advance another transportation funding proposal. There's been increasing interest as the nickel and dime taxes are, the programs that were funded by those taxes are winding down to deal with some O&M issues, with the ferry funding issues, with the big projects that still remain to be funded, 520 and the rest of the North-South and Spokane, CRC and some of the, those other mega projects, as they call them. And we have about $3.1 billion worth of operations and maintenance over the next 10 years in the highway system that is not yet funded, about $300 million a year. And so there are folks out there who are advocating strongly. Many in the Washington Roundtable, the business community is pushing hard on this. They're going to put out a proposal themselves, and they want the governor to kind of get behind it before she goes out because she's... in their view, they argue that she's viewed as credible on the topic because of all the work that she's done over the last couple of years. She's not very excited, I will say, about having the last things she injects into this process being proposals for new revenue, but it's something that she's looking seriously at, has not made any definitive decisions. But I think she intends, whether there's an education funding proposal or a transportation funding proposal, we will probably do a book two to try to show the path to solve what we think is the closer to realistic problem that will be in front of the legislature as opposed to the statutory problem. So that's the biggest landscape. I know you all will be most interested in natural resources. She has, I think, you know, if you look back over the last several budgets, she's worked really hard to try to not have the funding reductions to the natural resource agencies be out of whack with what is happening in other places. That's a challenge because so much of what you all do comes out of general fund sources. The Discover Pass is not produced at the level that we hoped. So Parks is looking at options, and I know they're working together with you all to try to figure out what we can do about that because it's a topic that we all need to think about how we're going to make sure that we can continue to fund these programs. There will be a capital budget. There's you know, everybody has projects. Everybody and their brother has new projects for what we should do there. I don't know that we'll spend a lot of time on that because they'll end up monkeying with it so much after we leave anyway. So, but she will have capital budget proposals by before we go. Yeah, we thought we'd have a governor-elect by today. We don't. Hopefully soon because that certainty is good for everybody. I've been in close touch with both campaigns. They both believe that they will prevail in the end, and we will work hard to make sure the governor's charge to me personally was to make sure that this is the best transition and administrations that we've ever had. That probably doesn't surprise you that that's her orientation. She doesn't care who wins, or she has a personal interest, but as far as what we do hand over this administration, she wants to make sure that we are doing everything we can to tee the next group up, wherever they are, for success. I think we're well positioned to do that. There's always uncertainties like we're in right now. If this continues on for a while, we may need to revisit our plan, but hopefully we'll get some resolution soon and we'll know who the new team is and can start trying to work with them to stand up a new administration. So I'm happy to answer any questions on that or any other topic, but those are kind of the big things that we're working on right now. And I'm very interested. I talked to the governor earlier today about this conversation. She's keenly interested to hear what you have to say on several topics, and I have committed to her that she will hear from me as soon as we're done.
Did you have particular topics in the list that she wanted us to focus on?
She's interested in them all. She didn't want to pick favorites among them, but she wants to make sure we spend some good time talking about the Kids Opera proposal down in Oregon. And she wants to, since this would be our first opportunity to really kind of hear from you all on Wolves, we'd like to just get a sense of where you're at. Phil, I will say, did a fantastic job at staying in close contact with us through that whole process. But it was, you know, interesting. I think, you know, it probably, out of the 8 years of this administration, is in the top two to four topics on which we had the most input from the public. People were fired up. And on all sides of the question, I know many of those calls got referred to Phil, so we have that in common, but it's clearly something the public is very interested in, although I will say I don't think we're anywhere close to consensus on how we should handle these issues. So those are two big things, but whatever else.
And we had prepared. We knew that those were going to be two big ones. So then I'll just go through the whole list. And I'll start off, just wanted to brief you two on the what I consider very, very significant improvements that Gregoire's commission has made to just the administration of the agency. And what we've done that was, in my view, not being done by previous commissions before she appointed all of us, or many of us, is the commission wasn't really conducting itself as a true oversight board. And a reflection of that was the Burke Report, which I explained to Bob. I don't know if you remember the
I'm
Burke
Report. I'm familiar with it, yeah.
It was a diagnosis mandated by the legislature to review the problems within the department in regards to capital budgeting and implementation. The legislature had become fairly fed up with the fact that the agency was requesting capital budget funding that it could not use in a reasonable amount of time or as scheduled. So the
questions about because of the oversight of the funds, expenditure funds as well.
Yeah, so it's just a range of problems. And one of the problems that was listed in the Burke Report was that the commission was not acting as a proper board of directors. And without the commission acting as a board of directors, you had no supervision because it's not a cabinet agency.
Sure.
So we took that seriously and worked very closely with staff to apply remedies. And I think that we've made a practice each year of checking in, how is our follow-up to the book report going, and the problems that led to the legislative outrage, in my opinion, have largely been cured. I don't think that there's the same kind of criticism of our department that I heard when I first joined the commission in 2005 on a number of fronts.
Are there areas that you're still concerned about or things that you think we can still improve on?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the ethos should always be look for improvements. And I think Phil and company have instituted that kind of an attitude within the department. So I think we are always looking. There's always room. The other way in which we've improved the administrative functions, the relationship between the commission and the director's office, has to do with the institution of the performance agreement with the director that is well thought out. When I joined the commission in 2005, then Director Kannings was not being, his performance was not being evaluated each year. We had no specific performance agreement with him. So it's very difficult to hold the administration of the department accountable. And that is one of the premier functions of the commission. So I ask you to relay this to the governor.
Absolutely.
That as her appointees, we have taken our job very seriously in that regard. We are having annual performance agreement evaluations with Director Anderson, and he's been doing marvelously, as you probably know quite well. The annual reviews show that our performance agreement with him is being used for as the basis for strategic planning as well as supervision of staff within the agency. So down the chain, those measures are being repeated and incorporated into the agreements with staff. So on the administrative side, I think we've made vast improvements.
Thank you for that. It's terrific.
Yeah, and I would assume that I'm very strongly interested in that.
She is indeed. And I'll say, Yeah, I asked Phil to be here today, and we talked a little bit about the fact that this part of the conversation could be slightly uncomfortable for him either direction. Because one of the things I'm sure you all have seen in Phil, as I have, that he's not a person who seeks out accolades. He's a person who just wants to get things done and be a contributor to success. And you know, one of my functions as chief of staff is to chair the cabinet, and even not as a cabinet agent, agency specifically, Phil's contributions to that group and his voluntary participation there have been a tremendous asset to us. And I thank you for selecting him and for allowing him to continue to do that work. It means a tremendous amount to this administration for us to be able to coordinate in that way on these issues that are so important to all of us.
And of course, it's mutual.
Yeah.
Because if he was not warmly invited into the cabinet meetings, we would be not as well connected in with the strategic direction the governor's taking. So it's just been, I know he's appreciated it. He's mentioned it many, many times.
It's certainly something we will encourage the next administration to carry on. Obviously, they will organize themselves as they wish, but I think it's been a great benefit to all of us to be able to have that kind of closeness and the relationships that develop there among directors. You could do it otherwise, and I'm sure Phil would find ways to continue to be effective. It's just a tremendous benefit, I think.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, that's what I was going to say about the administrative improvements. Then we'll launch into Columbia River.
Everybody's favorite.
Well, the first point we wanted to bring up, Commissioner Mencken was going to speak to, because he is on the Hatchery Scientific Review, scientist, and it does have a connection with the Columbia River reform.
I hear about that from Congressman Dix about once a quarter. So it's usually a relatively high volume.
Yes, yes.
He's an enthusiast.
Yeah, he's been a great supporter of Hatchery Reform.
Yep. It's you can't really call it a loss because he certainly put in his time, but we will miss him.
Yep. Well, I listened to the attorneys this morning, and they said that the best way to approach a tough issue is to tell a compelling story. And then I realized I don't have that length of time, so I'm just going to launch right into this. The hatcheries on the Columbia River and in the state of Washington are primary contributors to harvest in this state. They have another function as well, which is saving endangered and threatened gene pools through captive culture. So they have a dual role in the state. But if you look at what they contribute in terms of percentage of harvest, the hatcheries in the state of Washington, primarily on the Columbia River and in the Puget Sound Basin, contribute 70 to 80% of the harvestable fish in the state. So but you also know that a number of them are listed either as endangered or threatened under the Endangered Species Act.
Right.
This complicates the issue because you have to separate out in harvest, you have to separate out the hatchery fish from the wild fish under a new policy that has been established by the department. And that is, in 2009, the commission adopted what's called the Hatchery and Fishery Reform Policy, which is policy C3619. And this policy defined policy guidelines, including the goal of achieving the goals of set forth by the Hatchery Scientific Review Group, or the HSRG, which is the process that you referred to as with the support of Norm. This included broodstock standards for these hatcheries. This is the first time that any hatchery system that I know of in the North Pacific, where more than 5 billion fish are being produced for release, in all of the North Pacific. This is the first policy that addresses in a strong way the retention of genetic integrity of our wild stocks as separate from our hatchery stocks. And the key principle underlying this policy is the need to selectively harvest excess hatchery fish and increase the percent escapement of the listed wild populations consistent with meeting this hatchery reform policy. The scientific principles upon which this policy was adopted relies on published information in the scientific literature that recognizes the inherent genetic differences between domesticated hatchery fish and natural fish that we're trying so hard to recover. And these hatcheries, it's been recognized for a long time that these hatcheries, if not managed properly, can delay and in some extreme cases stop the natural recovery of our wild populations. And I'll give you a couple of examples here. For example, when hatcheries receive adult fish back to the hatchery, they do not allow the fish to spawn naturally. So there's no assortive mating occurring as occurs in under natural conditions. They knock them over the head, they strip the eggs and the sperm and everything thereafter until the fish hatches is unnatural. Even after they have hatched and they're in the raceways, these juvenile hatchery fish are grown under relatively unnatural conditions. They lack cover, structure, and substrate that they normally would have under wild conditions. This type of domestication selection in hatcheries acts to reduce what we call the fitness of the hatchery fish if they happen to return and spawn with natural populations. And the result is a loss in reproductive success of the fish. The natural fish that are returning do not reproduce at the same rate, especially when they breed with wild fish in those areas. They pass on some of those domesticated traits, and that reduces the survival of those fish. But the intent of our policy here is to be achieved through a number of strategies, including broodstock management, how the fish are handled at the hatchery, selective fisheries through mass marking of all hatchery fish. And again, this is a favorite of Norm's with his funding for mass marking, and the establishment of wild fish management zones. In the Kitsopper plan for the Lower Columbia River, there are some potential pitfalls in releasing greatly increased numbers of hatchery fish for the Lower Columbia River fisheries, insofar as it will be difficult to remove enough hatchery fish without the repetitive handling of listed fish in both commercial and recreational fisheries, because you will have an extremely large percentage of the fish returning as being of hatchery origin. There is some doubt among agency scientists, both state and federal, that the plan can be accomplished without jeopardizing wild fish recovery. And what you will see in one of the plans that this commission is working with the Kitsopper commissioners, is that already they're girding their loins, so to speak, for the reduction in the proposed number of coho. From like 4.9 million enhancement of coho in the safe areas in the Lower Columbia River, which will be feeding into the commercial fisheries primarily, from 4.9 million to something like 1.9 million. So it could have a major effect if we follow strictly the rules and guidelines set forth by our hatchery policy and by the Hatchery Scientific Review Group. My sense is that these kinds of issues can be worked out. They may be expensive fixes in some cases by, you know, incorporating more weirs on river systems or finding a way through fishery management to put more fish into the commercial fisheries, which is what we're trying to do to begin with. But it's an extremely complex system. It's got lots of moving parts. And the proposals, it's kind of like betting on the come. Because we don't really know how this is all going to work out. We don't know what the budget issues are going to be associated with, and one of the other commissioners, I think, will be addressing that. But we're optimistic that these problems can be solved and still with good protection of our natural fish.
Okay.
Thanks. I think Raleigh's going to speak with you about Eastern Washington perspective.
If I can, let me start with a couple of personal comments, and I think I can speak for all my colleagues and thank the governor for the opportunity to serve her on this commission. It has not been without its challenges, but it's a very collaborative group, and I think we've been very proud to have served. Secondly, and this has been touched on, and I think even more importantly, your open door policy to include our director has been immensely helpful. We get a sense of her wishes through him, vice versa. I think he speaks in for us, and that has been great. In the old days, he actually served on the cabinet in those roles. To the topic at hand, the Columbia River fisheries reform, and I'm to address the eastern portion of the park, which is being that is my home. That's it's easier. I'm one of your three of your eastern Washington representatives, and in general, our fisheries constituencies, both tribal and non-tribal, which are the last in line for fishery fishing opportunities, and we're some 572 miles, nine dams up the Columbia River. Fishers have been frustrated with pre-season forecasts and predictions with many management actions that often have left them with shorter seasons and fewer fish. This very same holds true with mid-Columbia fisheries and those in the lower Snake, which are still in Washington. They are also concerned about short seasons and fewer fish. Let's see where I am. I have to admit, we also have conservation concerns, because if we are barely meeting our escapement goals, not only are our fisheries shortened, but also it imperils recovery. And we all want to see the Columbia River recover. We've had some recent short-term, very positive fisheries, but we're looking long-term. This group of people have been very creative, Marty, in ways to improve their own situation. And a great example, in part to offset the department fiscal constraints that we've had in recent years, they put together, by the way, and those constraints actually threatened whether we would have fisheries in the Wenatchee, the Anyap, and the Methow Rivers. They put together and developed the Salmon and Steelhead Enhancement Act. That act imposes a fee on all recreational users from 15 years and older. That's about 120,000 licensed. It has averaged $1.5 million for the department in the last 4 years. And thanks to the governor's support, thanks to the department's support and the bipartisan support that we had, the legislature adopted the program. It's been an overwhelming success, and we're 4 years into a five-year program, and it sunsets. So that's one that you may want to refer as a possible addition, because the funds are directly funneled to improving recreational fisheries or creating new recreational fisheries. So it's recreational fishermen investing in themselves, and it's been a really positive show.
Does it expire in 2013 or 2014?
14.
Okay.
Well, let me continue on the local and river fishery reform. Yes, both the upper and the mid-Columbia River support change, and we heard this actually yesterday in our testimony that we had on this topic. They don't support the indiscriminate nature of gill nets in the mid-stem Columbia. But I think it's fair to say, and this is a really important piece from these people, they also understand that this is a 100-year-old fishery. It supports families. It supports small communities in the lower river. So we agree with the principle of the equity with providing viable fisheries for the gillnet fishers as we reshift. And this is not a reallocation. Hopefully this is a reshifting of these fisheries. And so that's a key point to get across. Furthermore, the Upper Columbia River fishers are keenly interested in protecting the investment that they are making in enhancement. The Colville Tribe has output 2.4 million Chinook, 80,000 steelhead into the system annually. That hatchery comes online next year. Thank you, Norm Dix. Interesting, the Canadian bands, which are tribal communities, they're about to put 4 million sockeye into the river. Similarly, the Bureau is about to put almost 10 million fish in the Snake River. So we want to make sure that a portion of those fish come back to the people that actually are releasing these fish. you know, to make all this work, and I'm one of the three select people that represent our full commission, we have diligently looked at what are the unique needs of Washington. Even though Oregon has put forward a proposal, we represent the people of this state. We work for our governor. And so we've looked at this a little different than they may have. We're very collaborative in the process. We like much of what is on the table. But let me just give you three or four things that we feel that are Washington's, in Washington's interest. One, assuring reciprocity. We have lived in score for scores of years with Oregon being able to fish in Washington and vice versa. We enforce both sides. We want to ensure that for our gillnet fishermen. We have put on the table the concept of buyback. The industry, some have said we don't need it, some have said we might, but it's an opportunity for those that may want it, especially those that are close to retirement. And that would help the situation. If some moved out, that gives more and a better opportunity for those that are left.
Do you have funding ideas for that?
We do. We want to do it now. It might be take a little time. Why don't suffice to say the concept would be to entice the recreational community to help invest in that because they could be the benefactors of the fishing long run. So that's the short of it. Do we have that agreed to or even on the table? No, we're working on it. In the move of the gillnetters off the main stem, you know, we do want to assure an economic opportunity in the safe areas and also in the fall fisheries. And that can be through enhancement and specifically on fisheries preferences in the fall period. And we're working hard to make that work.
Can we touch on that in a little bit more depth? Because that seems like kind of a key criteria for the whole thing if we're going to remain true to the equity commitment. How do we ensure that there, how do we develop confidence that those opportunities
that we can
are going to...
And that's a good question. Oregon put on the table something that in essence we've agreed to, and that is that there should not be more than a 0 to 5% impact on the short term during this transition. We're modeling, we want economic data to make these decisions, and it looks like they do much better. In the first 4 years, you know, our model shows 16 to 20% potential growth for them.
Is that in numbers of fish or economics?
Economics is what I wanted to make sure I could see it. This probably deserves a longer-term briefing for the staff and through Phil and maybe some of us. But I was going to say, we have an honest concern in this process about funding. Are the dollars going to be there? Or do we simply have a hollow promise at the end of this? And to address that, we do two things. One, we have an adaptive management process so we can be flexible if we're not meeting our goals. But I think the other part of it is that we've asked for a midterm check to see if we need to do course corrections before we get to the end. It enlightened me today. The director said something that he realized that most of the fish that we're reshuffling are all Washington fish. They're coming from Washington hatcheries. You know, Washington has a very big stake in this. A couple other points that I need to share my time. We do have one conservation issue as well, and it's not that we're talking about salmon fisheries, but this incidental harvest in particular on a species of concern, and that's sturgeon. And we have sent a note indicated to Oregon that if there's not a sign of recovery by our December assessments, that we will be proposing to go up to a catch and release fishery for all sectors, commercial and recreational. And I think that's a very good thing to do. We await feedback from Oregon as far as the comments that we put into this proposal. We'll get that next week. Somewhere the following week would be a very good time to get with Bob and others and get them fully up to speed. Larry Carpenter is going to give you a view of the Little Columbia River sports fishing perspective.
Great.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, of course. Thank you. Hey, Larry.
Mr. Loesch. Bob Nichols, my name is Larry Carpenter from Mount Vernon. First thing I want to say, I want to be real brief. These two guys took some of my notes, but I've been on a number of boards and committees and so on over the years, and it's such a pleasure to work with my constituents here, a more dedicated group of people on behalf of the state's resources. You can't be found, and that's also to be said about Director Anderson. So I've been asked to speak by Chairman Weckert about the recreational industry, of which I've been involved in for 35 years, and in particularly the Columbia River. The economic contribution of the recreational fishery over the last few years have been of very distinct help to the agency by participating in meetings, process to increase fees and licenses to offset some of the general fund reduction, and they're very, very proud of that, and they feel like they're part of the solution, not part of the problem, and it's a whole different energy out there between government and the recreational community now. I was going to speak about the Columbia River endorsement to the $1.5 million. Commissioner Schmidt did that. Being in the recreational industry, it's a magnitude of revenue increases is significant as it relates to sales of product recreationally, boats, motors, tackle, and the licenses that go with those for the license for the boat, the trailers, as well as the fishing licenses or hunting licenses in some cases that are purchased thereafter. One of the keys to our current opportunity and future opportunity in my mind is selective fishing. It's done a lot of things. It's helped protect ESA listed fish, all the things that you've already heard. But what it's also done is it's created a whole different attitude amongst the recreational community, a higher regard for the resource. They're very thankful to have the opportunity, so they're much more engaged in learning the right ways to participate in the fisheries and release fish and so on. And having said that, I think that the selective fishing piece throughout the state, Puget Sound, Columbia River and others, is really a pathway to the future. That's, I think, where we have to be as it matches up on the Columbia River with 13 species of ESA-listed salmonids. We have to fish selectively. And frankly, gillnets in the lower river are indiscriminate killers, as the other commissioners both spoke of. And based on the ESA needs and requirements of the federal government, we have to fish selectively. And frankly, that also creates the opportunity and allows for much better, more precise management by the agency, allowing them to meet all the guidelines through the modeling process. So, you know, very briefly, the recreational fishing industry is almost $2.5 billion industry, and frankly, it does a lot to fuel the engines of government, and they're anxious to participate in working to grow that opportunity. I'm one of the three musketeers that have been singled out, along with Commissioner Mankin, Commissioner Smitten, and Mr. Duvier as an alternate to be matched up with the Oregon group of three. And
done something terrible in the past.
it's very interesting, lots of moving parts. But having said that, I truly believe at this point that we're striving and we will have a positive outcome for both the recreational and the commercial communities. I really believe that, and that's what our focus is, and we'll try and get the job done.
What do you hear from the recreational fishery about commitment to this principle of equity, of trying to ensure that there's vitality in the commercial fishery when we're done with this?
Well, Mr. Loge, I guess that depends who you talk to. If you try to find a group of rednecks, it's probably not very good. If you try some pragmatic fishermen and certainly people from industry, the people from industry that I'm part of, the tackle industry and others, they're aware that that has to be done. That's part of their mandate. And it's just like selective fishing years ago when it was implemented. A lot of the recreation community fought it because they didn't understand it. Now they understand it and they have buy-in and they want to grow it with it. And I think it's our job to make sure that the playing field is level, the landing is soft, the commercial industry has an opportunity to thrive into the future, and along with that, so will the recreational industry, and that's good for our state.
As I'm sure I'm the least informed person in the room on all this stuff, but my general observation is that it feels to me like the recreational public underappreciates the importance of the commercial fishery to ensure the long-term success of ESA listing and recovery to get the hatchery fish out of the system so they're not taking out space. And I don't know how we help people understand that better, but it's part of what creates opportunity for them to have. We need the vibrant commercial fishery.
Well, that's a great comment. I think it's a learning process. I think the agency, Director Anderson's leadership and his staff have gone a long way to educate the people that now start to attend the meetings are part of the process. And, you know, in some cases, I don't think recreation is understanding commercial and vice versa, you know. But it's come a long way in my 25 years of being involved in the North of Falcon management scheme. It's improved many, many times over, and we got a lot of work to do yet.
Well, I called O'Connor home, and I bought a boat motor from you a couple years ago, and it's running great.
Small world.
Wow, thank you.
I'm probably the only person.
I'm still in Mount Vernon.
Customer. No, too?
Yeah, right. You live in O'Connor?
Yeah.
Oh, over there. Uh-huh. Stop by again. We got coffee.
Absolutely. It's better in the morning than in the afternoon.
And the motor still runs?
Absolutely. Running great.
Do you use it enough?
No, not enough.
Okay, well,
it's
we're going to work on that.
The nature of this opportunity that I have right now.
Thank you for your business.
Thank you.
And please. Gary Dubiec is going to talk about the efforts we're going to make sure that the commercial side is taken.
Great.
This is kind of a unique situation, and you just, I think, pointed out a significant problem with the wrecks and the commercials.
It's such a challenge.
This group, I'll have to say, in the years I've been on it, that seems to be our territory is in the middle. And the Wolf and the environmentalists and the Hatfield and McCoys and everybody else, our job is to try to walk that line in between them. And here's a great opportunity for us to do that. And I think there is a great deal of misunderstanding on the value each of these stakeholders brings to the table. On a positive note, I think this offers us a unique opportunity for economic development for the state. I think we have been trying to demonstrate to the commercials how we can not replace or ban gill netting as we're wiping their industry out, but we are trying to restructure and redevelop their fishery into new areas and new opportunities. So what we've been trying to work on is not how to replace commercial fishermen, but it's kind of like when you have a Walmart come into a small community, the whole community has to change and businesses change and adjust, and it's kind of the 21st century dilemma. Well, gill netting is one of the problems that's probably old century type opportunities. So we now are trying to show that we can keep them whole, and as Raleigh pointed out, they will probably be enhanced even if we can move them into where we have abundance and away from where we have problems with selective fishing, so that we can continue to maximize our conservation objective and our mandate for ESA recovery. At the same time, trying to make sure that citizen of states get the best economic return. And I think because if we move some fish from the commercial side to the rec side in this outcome, we have an economic benefit to both states. And we have kind of a unique dilemma here, I think, in some ways. Oregon has 70-80% of the water, and we provide 70-80% of the fish. So we have a pretty good need to work together. So
fish don't do so good without water.
Right.
Water without fish isn't much fun.
Exactly. So I think this is building a new bridge. We've had our problems coordinating effectively with Oregon Commission in the past. We went through this process in 2008. And we're on this line of conservation. So it's nothing new to a lot of us here, but it's consistent with our hatchery reform. It's consistent with our selective priority in trying to make sure we get the right kinds of fish back on the spawning grounds. And if we do it appropriately, this could be a win economically for both states, and we can maintain both stakeholders whole. And I think we can also increase the vitality of some businesses on our rec side. It looks like there is more difficulty long term as a commercial fisherman inside the Columbia. I wouldn't say that's probably the best opportunity to invest in. But it's something, I think there's going to be a lifestyle there, there's going to be some opportunity there. But it's certainly something that's going to be under a lot of stress in these kind of economic times that we're going through, that we have to make sure that we spend our money correctly, appropriately, and get the best for our citizens and for both states. And this is one I think we can do that. We're going to make some minor shifts, and over the next 4 years, I think, for the most part, we're going to make everybody better economically.
How do you feel? This timeline seems quick. My understanding is both commissions are looking maybe to consider action in December. That seems like a lot faster than we've considered these kinds of pretty significant decisions in the past.
Well, as I mentioned, this really has been worked on since 2008. Mm-hmm. And for us, this has been a slow, agonizing process. Mm-hmm. And our staff has been working on this same strategies, and it's very consistent with our other science that we've been doing. So this is a continuation of what we've been wanting to do to get to the end results of better conservation, more economic benefit to everybody. So though it looks like it's fast, it happened to be that all of a sudden Oregon got on our page. So I think it's probably fast for Oregon, and we're trying to educate them and bring them along with us. But for our side of the river, we are not doing this fast at all. We're maybe doing a little bit of the process faster than we need to. In terms of the science and the logic and the planning, it's long-term strategy that's being worked out at this time. It's like a lot of things. The opportunity came, and we were ready.
Can I footnote that as well? We're hopeful of reaching a draft agreement. There's a lot of process that follows. One, that's just agreement between three commissioners from both states. We have to then seek agreement of everyone here. Should the commission in Washington, and that will be brought back to the governor, I'm sure, should the commission then agree to that, we'll see if Oregon agrees. Then we have the process of public hearings, rule setting, policy change. So this is... The front end may look quick, but there's still all the due process that goes to government that will follow.
So since the governor's not here, one of the things I know she would be interested in is, do you think there's something constructive that she could contribute to this discussion, either by communication with Governor Kitzhaber or with the stakeholder groups or to the public at large? If she were here and asked, what should I do, what would you tell her?
I guess what I would say is we'll know much better next week if Oregon accepts what we view our Washington needs. If that doesn't happen, then someone like the governor, and she still would have time to really interject and help us in that process. I have no sense. I missed the very last meeting where Oregon was aghast with our... We don't feel they're egregious or outlandish, but we do feel they represent what our people need, and we absolutely need to put this on the table. So next week we'll know a lot better. There may be other views on this too.
I think there's another benefit to the entire state, and this is, I think, a very significant opportunity to merge the upper river and the lower river. That's another divided line that we have. There's extremely great opportunity in the upper river that we have not tapped, and it's part of this process will, over the next number of years as the Joseph Dam comes up, the hatchery comes on, and I think we'll get more up and down the river movement, which is extremely beneficial to all the communities and industries, and I think this is the start of maybe starting to think about the Columbia River as the whole river instead of the little Bonneville.
I think the no-brainer, too, is that quite a few of the elements of this proposal that we're working out assumes that there will be additional production in the lower river for the commercials in the safe areas. We're considering a new safe area in the Kathlamet Channel. That's an idea that was put on the table by the Kathlamet interests, the commercial interests there. We're contemplating needing some additional production. As I understand it, Oregon is going to take responsibility for most of that additional production. But we're putting on the table a commitment of, say, $250,000, is it dollars or fish?
Fish.
Yeah, so we're saying that we're gonna contribute a portion of the additional production. And we don't have any money.
These are small releases.
Yeah. So we don't have any in our current budget for that. We expect that once the ideas are fully fleshed out, we will be beginning the conversation to see if we can drum up sufficient support on both sides. And we've been hearing that the sports interests will go to bat for the commercial interests at that point. So the money will be looked for, and the governor's help in that way would be very helpful.
And I don't think, sir, we should let Mr. Dix go totally to retirement, perhaps be an assignment that he might like on his legacy to chase down some money.
Indeed.
We know that this is a difficult time to be talking about bringing new money into the Serena, so appreciate Congressman Dix's help. Still to be worked out.
I just want to say, I think we're real fortunate to have the people from the commission that we do on that working group. When you look at the expertise that we bring to the table between Raleigh, Connie, and compare it to the brand new commissioners on the Oregon side, I think that's a little bit of the challenge where we're coming, and I'm speaking for them, but we're coming in with, they're coming in, because I haven't really been part of that discussion, but, you know, with some concepts and approaches that we've been working on for quite some time, saying, okay, well, you know, you started this process, we've got some really mature ideas, and they're sort of looking at us like, oh, we have a very steep learning curve to be able to understand, you know, the nuances, the subtleties associated with this. So that's a challenge we're dealing with. But
well, it looks like we only have about 10 minutes.
We should be able to take care of wolves in 10 minutes.
Yeah.
Holy smokes.
Well, we're going to hand it over to Commissioner Caney and Commissioner Jennings, who are very involved in wolf recovery in their own rights. So.
I'll lead off, and I'm glad to be here as well. And my name is Jay Caney. I'm out of Omak, Washington, and I'm one of the newer members on the commission. And again, I'd like to reiterate that great effort by all these people on the wolf issue, and I'm just so pleased to be a part of it now. But coming from Eastern Washington and having kind of an open mind to wolf recovery, I give a new definition to the term thrown to the wolves because it's been a little rough out there.
Yeah.
But, you know, I take a lot of pride in what this commission has done. I worked for 30 years with Natural Resource Conservation Service, and I help ranchers and farmers constantly to think about new management techniques that preserves their resources. And I think that's what the wolf issue is going to amount to as well. When I got to the commission, the wolf plan, conservation plan, had already been passed unanimously by the commission, and they were already at work on a position paper that stated, you know, but we heard all your concerns, you know, in the public meetings and the thousands of comments, 65,000 comments, I think. The commission was worried still that, you know, yes, we approve of wolves coming back in this state. We have a good management plan. I think it's scientifically supported. But we heard those concerns. And a lot of those concerns come from not the 70% of the people that seem to want wolves back, which is primarily more Western Washington folks, but those concerns come from that 30% that are in rural countrysides that really feel, I think, like wolves moving into town is kind of like Walmart coming. You know, to say what Gary said, it's like you're thinking about how can I adjust my business strategy, how the things I have to change, and they're not even sure this was, you know, just wasn't brought on by the Department of Wildlife. You know, there's still that thought process out there that this was, the government brought this on us, even though wolves have been naturally migrating in. So those concerns have to be heard. The concerns of the environmental community have to be heard. And I believe somewhere in that middle ground is where we're headed with the work we're doing is to help that happen. The recent activities around the Wedge Pack, And I work for a conservation organization in my spare time. And, you know, they were one of the first to join with the cattlemen and the Department of Wildlife when that pack had to be removed and say, hey, this is not a good thing, but we support it. And I think that's the kind of effort that will bring some of the fringe ideas more to the middle and have the concept that living with wolves doesn't mean livestock won't die. And it doesn't mean that wolves won't die. It just means that we're all going to have to get used to something that we haven't had around for 80 or 90 years. I mean, it's a brand new phenomena. And there's people that are, you know, just wishing it wasn't around. And you really have a hard time blaming them when it's ranchers that are getting by on a very slim profit margin. So I think the positive things that are happening are that I think we learned some things from the wedge pack. I don't think major mistakes were made. Honestly don't. I think it's a process that we're going to learn from. And I think the director has been very open to that learning process. We just took a recent trip to the Blackfoot Challenge in Montana that has had some success. I think some of the messages that came back from that for me and hopefully for the director were that there's no silver bullet. Hate to use that term, actually. Right.
They're extremely expensive.
Sorry. But there's no...
Werewolves.
Yeah. There's no one thing fits all. There's no... I think the message I got was you need a big bag of tricks and you need to try things and you need to apply practices and you need to have an education program and information and work with ranchers and work with people affected, talk to hunting groups, listen to their concerns, have an active research program that's looking at the basis of, you know, maybe three or four predators now in a system on prey species, you know, because the hunters here really haven't joined the fray yet. We haven't heard that much of their voice because they don't have anything affecting them yet. But as wolves continue to grow, and they're growing at a rapid pace in the state, we're going to hear more from them. We're going to have these same discussions that we're having with livestock owners and department, as well as now with the ungulate or the hunters and the department. So getting ahead of that's important, and I think that we're looking to be on top of that. The message that wolves, the population is what you're trying to preserve, not necessarily individual faces of wolves on magazine covers, is not what we should be thinking about or looking at. People kind of get too emotional about it on all sides. And so as we start to learn that we're thinking about this as a population recovered from the environmental side as well as the ranching side, I think we're going to start to come to that middle ground. And that means that some packs in the future, there might need to be packs taken out again. We don't know that that won't happen. There undoubtedly will be individual animals that turn to depredation that will have to be taken out. And that was a lesson we heard in Montana as well, was have a very solid program of non-lethal with as much help from as much organizations as you can get, including the WDFW, have good staff in the field, have a real concise and clear method of determining confirmed depredations, and when that happens, sometimes you have to just take out offending animals as quick as possible. That's probably your best chance to preserve the rest of the pack. Now that thought process has to get out there to the public more. You know, it's management of wolves, and it's going to be hard, and it's going to be not everybody will get what they want. I really believe that when Western Washington starts having wolf incidents and depredations on llamas and things like that, you know, in ranchettes and whatnot, they'll understand that better. That's going to take some time. On the flip side, I think as ranchers start to realize the power of the public's voice that wants wolves back, you know, that they're going to have to realize, too, that we just can't go back to the days when there weren't wolves. And so I think that, you know, all sides are going to eventually, hopefully, end up more in the middle and work towards these solutions. And I see some positive things that are happening in other states. I see some good examples. And, again, we have to be open to take what will work here and apply it, try it. If it doesn't work, move on to the next tactic. But there's some things that give me a lot of hope. And I enjoy working on it. I'm a hunter. You know, I do a lot of talks to hunting organizations in my job, and I'm hearing their concerns too. You know, and that's, like I said, that's coming, that people will start to worry about their hunting location and how when wolves come back into the Nanum and the Kalakum and the Yakima area where there's lots of elk, and eventually into the Gifford Pinchot area. You know, there's going to be voices that need to be heard from the hunting community.
So I did want to step back and say I've been really proud of how this commission dealt with the whole adoption of the Wolf Plan, and a lot of that credit really goes to our chair and our vice chair for understanding early on how big a deal this is going to be, making sure we scheduled enough time, special meetings to get a lot of input to make sure that we were all understanding of what the trade-offs were, what our options were, and how to do that. So I just want to say thank you to you guys, because it was a difficult row to hoe, and you guys did a good job with it. And that really resulted in a unanimous adoption by all the commissioners, which I think was a very powerful message back to the legislature. One of my big concerns was if we had a split decision, all of a sudden it would give someone an opportunity to take it up to the legislature, and all of a sudden we're dealing with wolf policy at the legislative level, and that's not really the way we want to see policy made. So a lot of kudos to the two of you to help us to get to where we are. Wolves are an emotional issue for a lot of people, and especially from that sort of animal rights, animal lovers perspective. And there is going to be a certain segment of the population that will not want to understand that individual lethal take is a necessary part of managing wolves. So I don't think we're never going to get a total buy-in on how we're managing wolves in the state. But I think the approach that we're taking as a commission, as a department, is really gaining, and is continuing to gain credibility with those reasonable voices on both sides. I believe that the Cattlemen's Association has much more buy-in and support's a strong word, but understanding that we are working with them to make it work, that we understand and we're not a bunch of West Side environmentalists that just want wolves back at any cost. When we actually did the lethal take, I think we gained a lot of credibility with them. At the same time, we're doing our best to be transparent and explaining to the conservation community about why lethal take is sometimes necessary and why we are doing our best to pull together a list of non-lethal options, an array that local farmers and ranchers can use so that we don't get to that lethal take situation. So we're not rushing out to shoot wolves, but we're also willing to shoot wolves when it's necessary. And I think that's a very powerful message on both sides. And I think we're doing a very good job as a department and as a commission to understand that among ourselves and be willing to accept those hard decisions when they're time to be made. So
I just have to add another kudo or two that just has to be stated. Director Anderson and his staff, the work that they've been doing, I mean, compared to what little we do, relatively speaking, yeah, we listen to the public, we get together once a month. Those guys are doing the hard lifting. and the dedication that we've seen, you probably already are well aware of. They've been doing a truly stellar job. Then the other group that deserves some credit here is the AG's office. Because one of the reasons that we were all together voting unanimously is because of the excellent and thorough advice that we were given by the AG's office. They're there with us every step of the way. They helped answer our question in one executive session after another, which we were in private because we're allowed to do this under the rules. Asked them lots and lots of questions about how we stay out of trouble and what the rules are, what the laws are that we have to comply with. They were terrific. I think we went into this decision with full knowledge of where we had to end up.
You're in the wrong book of business if you want to stay out of trouble.
Hey, on this one, yeah.
Seems like trouble's going to find you.
But I mean, out of the five states, we're the only one that's taken on wolf management and hasn't been in court yet.
Say again?
We're out of the five western states that are in the Rocky Mountain DPS, we're the only ones that are managing wolves and we haven't been in court.
That's amazing. Yeah, I couldn't agree more about the kudos to the department. I think you all and they did a terrific job in among the most difficult circumstances that any regulatory agency has. It's those kinds of events are as you all experience moments of very high stress and high focus, and you get battered on from all sides. It's very difficult, and to try to create a space where you can make good decisions, where you can support staff who are really on the front lines of trying to figure out what the right path forward is. And I think you did a terrific job. I'm glad to hear that you're continuing to look back to find ways to improve on what I think was a good job. Obviously, the first time out, there's going to be lessons we can learn from it. And those lessons are going to continue to be learned over the next several years. This is a new experience for all of us living now, because we haven't had these challenges before. And so I hope that you'll keep trying to explore new ways to respond to the situation and reaching out to all the groups. They're not going to go away. Their passion's not going to diminish. Their economic and social and cultural issues are not going to be any less than they are. But hopefully by continuing to create a place where people can talk and work through these challenging things, we can maybe find that middle spot of, if not support, at least understanding.
Understanding.
That's a good way to say it. Is that it for your agenda?
Well,
we're about
we had some more, but we're...
Go ahead. I think my time is yours.
Really?
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, we have two more topics.
Until 2:30.
Yeah. And the... let's just leave it at two. We don't need to talk about the budget anymore.
It's depressing.
Yeah, it's too depressing. The land management acquisitions and maintenance and operations issues, I was going to ask Commissioner Perry to talk about.
Thank you. My name is Chuck Perry. I'm from Moses Lake, served on the commission for quite a while, and I want to say that land management is kind of what I'm extremely interested in, and have pushed the department, tried to push the department in various ways to recognize the land resource that they have, which is probably the biggest single resource that the department has. It's a little bit less controversial than maybe some of this other stuff.
That's not a county.
That we've talked about so far. I'll start with a negative. You might be interested in the fires that occurred this summer.
A lot of time on those fires.
Yeah, Department of Land was involved in quite a number of those, almost two dozen fires on that overlapped onto Department land. Throughout the latter part of the summer, approximately 15,000 acres burned. A lot of that was on winter range areas, and really the department is still assessing that to see what the potential damage is. There is some figures on what that is going to cost. Again, that isn't final because they're still doing trying to retrieve information on some of the capital assets that were lost. But right now, it looks like it may cost the department $4 to $5 million in suppression costs. That would include infrastructure damage, actual suppression of a fire, and potential habitat restoration and possible erosion on those lands. Things that need to be done to get them into the best habitat condition into the future. The department has an active land acquisition program. They take advantage of a lot of cooperative projects. WWRC, they use money from any place they can get it to accomplish these objectives. The last 5 years, they purchased approximately 40,000 acres additional wildlife and recreation lands. Really not, it's surprising that in my experience, the public isn't, much of the public isn't aware the department even has lands. And I know there's been a push here recently to try to get more exposure on the department's website and through social media that seems to be really effective now, and hopefully the department lands and the management of those lands will get a lot more exposure. Discover Pass has, first of all, I'd like to thank the governor for her support on that Discover Pass.
Sure.
It was quite a while in the making, and it really hasn't lived up to its potential yet, but the department has still received approximately $1.7 million from that, which has helped greatly in developing particularly non-consumptive projects out there, people who are watchers, basically, and use our lands for various recreation things that don't involve hunting and fishing. And that's a huge segment of the public, and with those funds, we've been able to do a lot more projects. We'd like to do even more along that line. The department has also embarked, I think in coordination with Department of Natural Resources and Parks, some kind of a marketing program to get out not only what's available out there, but the fact that the Discover Pass is required and the value of that pass in what they can experience in Washington, which I think will be a real positive thing. Probably the other real highlight is long period of time. I'm not going to tell you how many years because I don't know exactly, but it was over a lot of years, the land exchange between Department of Natural Resources and Department of Fish and Wildlife. There was a few other agencies involved in it, but because of how land was given to DNR at statehood, it was basically checkerboard ownership, and so a lot of that DNR land was checkerboarded with Department of Fish and Wildlife land. There was often conflicts in terms of road management and other types of management on that land that because of the two agencies' different goals, it didn't really match up very well. And they felt that some kind of a land exchange would be really important. It went in three phases. That totaled all acres involved, over 52,000 acres, that if you look at the values, added up to probably in the neighborhood of $37 million. There was 34,900 acres of DNR land that became Department of Fish and Wildlife land, approximately 5,100 acres of land purchased under WWRP that went to DNR. That huge discrepancy in acres was the fact that we traded forested acres for open grassland shrub steppe acres that aren't worth as much. So with appraisals and so forth, that came out to be a fair value. There was also some other lands, including almost 8,000 acres of U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service land that was involved also that went to DNR. Those lands were actually managed by Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife. And again, those were mostly forest lands that probably would benefit DNR. And the shrub steppe areas, which are extremely limited in Washington and support a lot of species that tend to be listed threatened, endangered, so on, were probably more important to the department. But
what would an example be of shrub steppe land?
Excuse me?
What would be an example of shrub steppe land? What areas does the state have?
The non-timbered areas east of the Cascades.
Okay.
So if you drove down I-90 and got to Ellensburg, the open areas, okay, that would not be timbered from there, in fact, clear to Spokane. And a lot of those areas are now irrigated into productive cropland, which is a good thing. The ones that are those areas that are remaining, probably less than 40% of the total, support a lot of wildlife species and a lot of recreation, and we've tried to focus on those exclusively. I also want to say that I have a long history with department lands, and they were always kind of in the background, out there necessary to support fish and wildlife, but not a high priority, because most of the projects on those are long-term, and there's always a lot of other high-profile things, like wolves, as a, for instance, that took the spotlight. But with Phil Anderson becoming our director, the Department of Lands have got a lot more attention with the staff that he brought with him, and I think they're on a lot better management basis right now. I think wildlife habitat is being improved throughout the state, and it looks like we're on a real positive note. And I think as we've been sort of thinking about long-term funding for these lands, how to take care of the O&M, the habitat enhancement over the long term. And I know the Discover Pass, as it ramps up, which I'm sure it will over time, will be a huge help there.
Yeah, I just wanted to touch, I'm sorry, I forgot to introduce myself before, David Jennings from Olympia. I just wanted to touch a little bit on the Discovery Pass, and that, yes, it hasn't brought in the revenues we thought it would, but, and you're going to hear from Commissioner Smith about the big tent and how we're trying to build a constituency for the department that's bigger than just hunting and fishing. And we really look at the Discovery Pass as an opportunity for those bird watchers, non-consumptive users, to help pay for agency operations. And I'm really pleased to see the three agencies, DNR, DFW, and Parks, they've now hired an external marketer to help them figure out how to market it better, including such things as, can we get it into Costco and get it places where a lot more of the population will get exposed to it and be able to buy it. So there's a lot of optimism around how do we take this tool we've got and really make it a much more efficient tool and really help bring in those other people so we can get them exposed to the department and understand that they have a stake in making sure the department stays healthy financially as well as just hunting and fishing community.
When you think about the Discover Pass, I think a lot of people think about parks.
Sure.
Right? That's probably where...
Right.
56% of the Discover Passes that have been sold through our electronic licensing
right?
system and our dealers.
Sure.
Right. So, we're a big player.
Excuse me. I might add just one other thing. Early on when we met with Governor Gregoire, she expressed real interest in department lands. She heard a lot about, well, the department doesn't manage their lands very well, and the potential for ecotourism particularly. And I think we've gone a long ways to satisfy that, particularly with the Discover Pass funds. There's been a lot of trails established and viewing areas for non-game species, and they've really taken that seriously, and I would endorse everything that was said about that community. We need to have a better relationship and draw more of those folks in, and we're certainly working that direction.
I wasn't going to let you guys end until I heard this presentation, because you're in big trouble with me. My 8-year-old daughter went to the WGA meeting out in Clay Elum, where the Governor's Get Out West initiative and all the events that you all supported there. You've cost me a boatload of money.
Just don't give any more to Carpenter.
My daughter tried archery there and has totally got the vibe.
So, your $20 Segway fee is in the mail.
Yeah, I'm now a proud owner of a bow and a quiver and arrows and targets and lessons.
You are my visual aid.
Yeah. Exactly. You're killing me.
Okay, how do I pick up on that one?
Nice to hear from you, Brad.
My name is Brad Smith, and I'm from Bellingham, in the neighborhood to the north.
Thank you.
As we've been, echoes for everybody, it's been a pleasure and an honor to work with my colleagues here. It's been a good group through some very divisive and polarizing meetings. And I think, you know, when you look at the whole fin, fur, and feather, and claw world, most of these issues are very divisive and very polarizing. But there are some that are unifying, and there are some that we can all get around. When we sit in our row up and look at our audience, there's one thing that is in common, a lot of this color hair. You know, the future generation
and generations. We are all share, whether we are consumptive, non-consumptive, urban, rural. I think we want our children to have a better, you know, that's just normal human than we do. But we're not seeing that. The disconnect with children and nature is real. The popular literature is out there about all of that. You know, what we are trying to do here, it's not an easy thing. That's why we call it the Big Ten Committee, because we're still, it is a big idea. And we don't, Miranda was saying last night, the tenant may be a good metaphor, because it is outdoors. You know, I didn't think about it that way.
But everybody uses tent.
It's non-threatening. Sure. But looking at how do we have the next generation of children, for a lot of reasons, health reasons, getting them unplugged from what they're all plugged into on a daily basis, out into nature. And that nature can be consumptive or not, as David said. I mean, it can be bird watching. It can, and we participate in all of those. My particular interest a lot is more in the hunting and fishing part of that in youth, is that what we see, and this is a threat to all agencies of our ilk around the country, there's not going to be a generation of licensed buyers in the future. I mean, that it's going down, you know, hunting and fishing. And so how do we in Washington, and when we talked about this with the governor last year, she picked up right with the Get Out West idea, you know, and it all ties together. So where are we in this whole initiative? Well, the Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies, just, I haven't briefed you about this, Phil, because it just happened yesterday, I heard about it, just got a grant from U.S. Fish and Wildlife, and I shared this with the committee last night. Washington's going to be taking a lead in this grant, and it's... I have a conference call next week with the two PIs in New Hampshire and Arizona. The goal of that is specifically consumptive. It is hunting and fishing, getting kids more into that. But one of the things they want to do in the first year of the grant is hold a national summit. And we're trying to parlay that, at least in the couple of cups, to be here in Washington. And I think what sets the tone for where we're going with our Big Ten is what this bigger ten ideas around that table, or under that Big Ten, will be everything from Safari Club to Bass Pro Shops to Cabela's to, you know, the whole spectrum. Because if we're not having kids like your daughter with daddies buying them stuff, Cabela's aren't going to be selling anything. So in a world of red and blue states and personalities and conflicts, this is something I think we can rally around, because it's a common denominator. I think we can position ourselves, this state, as a leader in this initiative. So that it's not nailed down, but it is evolving, and it's evolving rather a little bit more rapidly this week than last because of this successful grant.
So, congratulations, that's terrific.
I think this will get the business community on board, it will get the hunting community, the non-hunting community, and we need bridges, you know, in this world of either ors. This is a common denominator.
The governor was really blown away through her whole WGA initiative and how much enthusiasm there was out there, and a sense of kind of unrealized potential for all the reasons that you're stating.
Well, the ecotourism and just get out west, the whole thing. You know, I even talked to Alaska Air a little bit, because in order to get out west, you got to get out west. You know, so and in these days of no budgets, and my other day job was, you know, dealing budgets of the west, which are all of those budgets, you know. But look at non-traditional ways of funding. And this is one that we can rally.
Sure.
What we're going to have in the next month is a little bit more nailed down package that we were talking about last night to take to some of our private sector partners.
Okay.
Not in a way of, please help us. It's, boy, we want them to say, can we help you?
Well, that's the response we got from the Outdoor Recreation Association and everybody else we talked to is they certainly wanted to be engaged. They were looking for opportunities. And frankly, you know, a year is too short to really try to make some serious progress there. Well, thank you for doing it. It's really important work. You know, before we finish, I guess I would I just want to say I'm going to finish my time here in 67 days, and it's been a very unique opportunity to work here for the people of the state of Washington. I've known this governor for 20 years. We've considered her and her family friends. I've watched those girls grow up to now becoming moms. My daughter was Courtney's flower girl. And I told her when she asked me to come join the second term of the administration that she's the only person who could have ever got me to come work for state government. And I have, I can't say I've loved every minute of it, but I've always considered it an immense privilege. And one of the things I will carry with me when I leave is how humbled I am and impressed by people like you who volunteer your time to do these really important functions. We couldn't do what we do without what you all bring. And there's it just continuously floors me because I've since overseen our board and commission's appointments and see everything that goes into the governor, just how many people are willing to step up and say, I've got something to give. And it's so important for our democracy. It's important for these institutions that we serve. For all the people who have no idea what you do, that you even exist or how these decisions get made, the thoughtfulness, the care, the dedication that you all bring to this work is truly inspirational to me as a citizen, and so important to this governor. She, you know, people don't get that governing is a team sport, and people like her, these new folks who have all kinds of great ideas, whichever one of them wins, will soon figure out that they can't do it on their own, that it's only because of the work that folks like you do, that people like Phil do, that they have any chance of success. So I just want to say personally thank you for everything you've done to support Phil and his work, to support this governor and hers, and for the people of the state.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.